Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Middle Ages by Maurice Bishop, read by Michael Page. 1. The Long Dark. The Middle Ages is an unfortunate term. It was not invented until the age was long past. The dwellers in the Middle Ages would not have recognized it. They did not know that they were living in the middle. They thought, quite rightly, that they were time's latest achievement. The term implies that the Middle Ages were a mere interim between ancient greatness and our modern greatness. Who knows what the future will call it? As our modern age ceases to be modern and becomes an episode of history, our times may well be classed as the later Middle Ages. For while we say time marches forward, all things in time move backward toward the middle, and eventually to the beginnings of history. We are too vain. We think we are the summit of history. The Middle Ages of Europe were a continuation and a formation. They were a continuation of old Rome in race, language, institutions, law, literature, the arts. They were also a continuation of cultures independent of Rome. The Franks and the Saxons, the Greeks and the Arabs contributed their own civilizations to Western Europe to help make the new civilization that we inherit. The English language, formed in the Middle Ages and drawn from every source, from Sanskrit to Icelandic, is a symbol of our blended culture. In a deeper sense, the Middle Ages were a continuation of the ancient peasant culture that goes back 10,000 or 20,000 years to the Stone Age. This depended on settled agriculture and the raising of domestic animals for food, clothing, and service. It possessed few tools beyond a crude plough and harrow, but it learned to adapt itself and to survive and attain a rude well-being. This peasant culture scarcely changed from millennium to millennium. It remains even to our own times. A highland farmer in Macedonia, a shepherd in the Auvergne Mountains, live a life more medieval than modern. An American pioneer of the last century, setting out with ox cart, axe, plough, and spade to clear a forest farm, was closer to the Middle Ages than to modern times. He was self-sufficient, doctoring himself and his family with herbs, raising his own food, pounding his own grain, bartering with rare peddlers, rejoicing in occasional barn dances for all the world like medieval carolies. But the Middle Ages were not merely a continuation. They were the formation of our world. A modern school of historians contends that the so-called Dark Ages were a period of ascent rather than of decline, that with the withering of the pagan classic civilization came the first budding of a new culture that was to develop into our modern civilization. When did these Middle Ages begin? When Rome fell. But when did Rome fall? No one knows. Historians have proposed many dates. A common one is AD 476, when the last emperor of Roman blood, Romulus Augustulus, was deposed by the barbarian Goth Odoacer. That date will do if we remember that the transition from ancient to medieval was slow, that at some time in the 4th or 5th or 6th century, the old Roman system of organization and behavior and thought was replaced, more or less, by another. Then it can be said that Rome had indeed quietly fallen. But why did Rome fall? We have far too many answers. There is the intellectual answer. Montesquieu said that the Romans conquered the world with their republican principles. They changed their principles to fit an empire, and the new principles destroyed it. There is the moral answer. License, luxury, and sloth, a decline in character and in discipline. The Christian answer of St. Augustine. Sinful Rome fell to prepare for the triumph of the city of God. The rationalist answer of 18th century free thinkers. Christianity, teaching non-resistance, otherworldliness, disarmed the Romans in the face of the barbarians. The political answer. Caesarism, loss of public spirit, the failure of the civil power to control the army. The social answer, or answers. The war of classes and the institution of slavery, which suppresses incentives toward change and progress. The economic answer, trade stagnation, low productivity, scarcity of gold and silver. The physical answer, Soil depletion, deforestation, climatic change, drought. The pathological answer, plague and malaria, or even lead poisoning from cooking pots and water pipes. The genetic and racial answers, the dwindling of the old Roman stock through war and birth control, and its mingling with Oriental and barbarian breeds. And the biological, cyclical, mystical answer, an empire is an organism, and, like a living creature, it must pass through stages of growth, maturity, and decline to death. Whatever the cause, the later days of the empire were marked by discouragement and fear, by what has been well termed a failure of nerve. The Roman Empire was like a declining business, whose program is retrenchment and retreat, whose ventures are desperate, whose employees can only shrug their shoulders and hope that the old enterprise will last out their time. Most of the old Roman magnificence remained, the great stone walls, temples, baths, aqueducts, theatres, and mansions. But the cities shrank in size and population. For instance, Autun in France dwindled from an area of 500 acres to less than 25. With the shrinkage came the abandonment of municipal services, street lighting, running hot water for the public baths, sewage systems. Weeds and bushes grew in the aqueducts, prying the stones apart. Roofs fell in, pavements heaved, refuse lay where it was thrown. Vacant houses were torn down for material to strengthen the walls. The cities had a battered, hopeless look. In the countryside, the population diminished. The old Roman slave-operated estates disintegrated, and farmland reverted to waste and marsh. Depopulation had begun in Italy and Greece in the 3rd century BC, and before long even Gaul was affected. The Roman army was kept to strength only through the recruitment of barbarians, a practice that was destined to bring disaster. The emperors invited immigrants from beyond the frontiers to colonize Italy, and even the uninvited joined them. Economically, the old system contracted or gave way. It had depended too much on conquest, tribute, slavery, and had fostered a fatal scorn for productive labor. Towns, in their subsidence, overspent their resources. Transport became dangerous and expensive. Wars, being mainly defensive, brought in no booty. As money lost its meaning, there began a gradual shift toward a natural economy. Communities reduced their wants, their scale of living, and learned to be almost self-sufficient. Still, there are always the smart and the lucky, even in disastrous days. The generals did well, and the high officials, and the sycophants, and clever Syrian and Jewish traders, and especially the large landowners. Some landowners fortified their mansions and kept private armies. They built their estates through imperial gifts or through purchasing the holdings of small landowners, who received in return protection against the taxing government and against marauders, native or foreign. Early in the Middle Ages, English literature began with the poet Cædmon and with Beowulf, composed with conscious artistry in a demanding poetic form. But their way of life was not much changed, and if they lost freedom, they gained security, a fair bargain in a tottering world. Here one sees the cell-like movements that were to develop into the feudal system. This age of mournful endings was marked by a great beginning, the rise of the Christian Church in the West. Christianity, with its beauty, its lofty ethics, its universal appeal, and its glorious promise of immortal bliss, was eagerly welcomed. Its triumph was assured by the conversion of the Emperor Constantine. Before his battle at the Milvian Bridge in Rome in AD 312, he saw in the sky a blazing cross with the words, in Greek, "By this conquer." He vowed that if he should win the battle for control of the empire, he would become a Christian. Indeed, he won, and indeed he became a Christian, although an uncommonly bloodthirsty one. Thus, Christianity became the official religion of Rome, while paganism lingered on in the countryside and among conservatives with antiquarian tastes. The success of the faith demanded its efficient organization as a church. Natural leaders gave it their full time and their zeal, and became priests and bishops. Like the empire, the church was organized into provinces, with the bishops as administrators. As the powers of the government decreased, they became the leaders, the tribunes of the people, took over the empire's civil and social functions, cared for the poor and sick. In the West, the first among bishops was the Bishop of Rome. He did not become pope until the 5th century. Previously, all bishops were called Papa. The preeminence of Rome was due in part to the prestige of the city, in part to Christ's pledge of primacy to St. Peter, in part to the vigor of certain great bishops of Rome, such as Gregory the Great, 590 to 604, who defended the city against the barbarians, established social services, promoted missionary work, and wrote much and well. The early age of Christianity was the age of the monks. Monasticism flourished first in the East, especially in Egypt, lending itself to a somewhat grotesque exhibitionism, with pillar-sitters and browsers who grazed on all fours. St. Benedict of Nursia in Italy, circa 480 to circa 543, brought common sense to monastic practice. His famous rule encouraged asceticism and otherworldliness without leading to excess. It prescribed, in reasonable proportions, prayer, praise, study, and labor in the fields. The rule is still the guide for many monasteries. From the 6th to the 10th centuries, during the times of cultural and economic stagnation that followed the fall of Rome, the monks held the Western world together. They provided most of the great missionaries. Reasonably secure, they preserved the ancient culture in their libraries, copying old books, making new ones, conducting almost the only schools. Monastery walls sheltered men with the impulse to escape the world, to seek virtue, to reflect on man's soul and his destiny. The monasteries were often compared to little paradises, refuges in an evil wilderness. Many of the church's institutions began during these years. The practice of pilgrimage was frequent from the 3rd century on. The cult of relics appeared early out of the East and led to unprincipled rivalries, holy souvenir collecting. The system of penance and penalty was codified. St. Columban, about AD 600, prescribed 6 lashes for a monk who forgot to say Amen, 10 for one who notched a table with his knife, 6 for one who sang out of tune. The liturgy took form. Great hymns were written. Confraternities or laymen's associations were formed. The cult of the Virgin Mary gained popularity. The first Western church dedicated to her was Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome. But the early church was riven by doctrinal dissensions. The most acute was caused by Arius in the early 4th century. His chief contention was that Jesus Christ, being created by the Father, must be inferior to him, hence only semi-divine. Under the leadership of Athanasius at the Council of Nicaea in 325, the Church ruled this to be a damnable heresy. Nonetheless, Arianism spread afar and was carried by ardent missionaries to the barbarian tribes, especially to the Goths, Vandals, Burgundians, and Lombards. Here was a mighty source of conflict. These barbarian tribes had long dwelt outside the Roman pale, and had long been filtering through the borders of the empire. Barbarian slaves, soldiers, gladiators trod the streets of Roman cities. Whole areas of the Roman domain had been set aside for settlement by allied tribes. Thus, a powerful fifth column prepared for the eventual eruption. The first invaders were the Germans who occupied Central Europe. East of them were the savage Slavs, and farther east, the still more savage Huns. The marauding Huns, balked by China's Great Wall, turned toward Europe and harried their western neighbors, inducing pressures that culminated with thrusts against the Roman defenses. The Germanic Visigoths crossed the Lower Danube in 376. They were a people on the march, a mounted army with women, children, and elders riding in carts. The horsemen destroyed the imperial infantry near Constantinople and killed the emperor. Under their famous leader, Alaric, they swept through Greece, then turned west and captured Rome in 410. The Goths found Italy too poor a country to support them. They moved across Gaul and into Spain to establish a Visigothic kingdom that lasted until it was submerged by the Muslims early in the 8th century. Then came the Vandals, whose reputation for wanton destruction is perpetuated in our common noun. The Vandals drove through Gaul and Spain and built a robber kingdom on the site of ancient Carthage. They came by ship to sack Rome in 455. They plundered for 2 weeks, stripping the roof off the capital because they thought it was gold. They carried off even statues, probably valuing the bronze more than the art. And then came the Huns, a people of Mongol origin. Westerners shuddered at their hairless yellow faces, deliberately scarred in babyhood, their beady, malignant eyes, their rank smell. Under their remarkable leader, Attila, the scourge of God, they invaded Gaul in 451. The Romans, the Visigoths, and various German tribes united against them and threw them back in a decisive battle near Troyes. The Huns then galloped into Italy and reached the walls of Rome, where Pope Leo the Great stood strong against them. When Attila suddenly died, they raised the siege and left Italy. The German Franks, who had been nibbling at the empire in what is now Belgium, advanced southward, and the Burgundians crossed the Upper Rhine and entered the land that was to be known thereafter as Burgundy. The dwindling Roman army, forced to defend its lines on the continent, gradually withdrew from Britain during the early 5th century. To the inhabitants who protested and pleaded for help, the Roman emperor replied that they must learn to take care of themselves. The Picts poured over Hadrian's Wall in the north. Scottish tribes harried the coasts from their homes in Northern Ireland. The Saxons, or Anglo-Saxons, came from the coast of Denmark and Germany to ravage England's eastern shores, and finding the land good, established permanent settlements. They wondered at the Roman remains, regarding them as the cunning work of giants. The native population, part Briton, part Roman, fought the Saxons long and well through 2 centuries, and even won a major victory in 571. One of their early leaders was King Arthur, in fact a British chieftain who fought against the invaders, in legend a noble chivalric monarch with his Knights of the Round Table. By the end of the 6th century, the Saxons were firmly established. The Britons, who refused foreign domination, retreated to the west, to Wales and Cornwall, and to Brittany across the Channel. There were 2 kinds of barbarian invasions: raids for booty and eruptions of settlers. The raiders for booty, such as the Huns, wanted what they could carry off on their horses, money and jewels, which were to be found only in the churches and in the homes of the rich. The spoilers might in high spirits commit a few atrocities and set fires, but the stone-built cities were not very flammable. In the countryside, the raiders might burn a smallholder's thatched barn and drive off his animals for food. They would not pause to trample his wheat and cut down his vines and fruit trees. The invasions for settlement were quite different. The newcomers wanted domination, not destruction. Their numbers were relatively small. Their hordes are estimated at from 20,000 to 120,000, including women and children. The fighting men were only a fifth of the total. These were nations on the march, like the Israelites seeking the promised land. They committed atrocities along the way, but extermination did not serve their purpose. The barbarian invasions were not a calamity to all dwellers in the empire. It made no difference to the ground-grubbing colonists whether his master was Roman or German, if only he was kindly. And there must have been many who never even heard of the barbarians. Off the track of the invasions, they led their changeless lives from day to day and from year to year, unconscious of the dooms that loom so big in history. Much of old Rome persisted under barbarian domination. The language, the forms of respect and worship, the institutions, the law, even the imperial ideal of unity. The cultures fused, intermarriage became general, the stocks blended. Learning faded, to be sure. The old Roman culture was literary, hence its appeal to writers of the past and present. But it had lost its creative force. Barbarian culture was one of action and power, not of record and tradition. It was unable, for the most part, to make reasoned reports on itself for our instruction, but it was busy transforming its world. In some ways, the newcomers made ordinary life better and easier. They brought with them new kinds of clothing, felt and furs, and above all the precious trouser. The old Gauls had known the trouser, but had abandoned it for the fashionable Roman toga. Mongolian trousers conquered the world, reaching even the Eskimos and the Iroquois. The barbarians introduced their dietary tastes, such as for rye bread and butter, and barrels and staved tubs, though these perhaps should be credited to the Gauls, and the wooden-framed saddle, and, apparently, the wheeled plough, which permitted the cultivation of the heavy, rain-sodden soils of the north. And in the realm of the spirit, the barbarians restored the heroic ideals of the warrior to a discouraged world. Of all the barbarians, it was the Franks who most determined the character of the age to come. It was their country of Frankland, or France, that became the type and centre of medieval civilization. The Franks, a Germanic tribe, are first to be discovered in the Low Countries and along the course of the Rhine. In 481, 15-year-old Clovis succeeded to the kingship of half the tribe. He invaded Gaul and gradually extended his power over the northern and western regions of the country, reaching as far as the Pyrenees. To do so, he had to subdue not only the Gallo-Romans, but also rival Germanic groups, the Alemanni, the Burgundians, and the Visigoths. At some time in the process, he was converted to Athanasian Christianity. His conversion, and that of his people, which automatically followed, established in the West a stronghold of Christian orthodoxy. Clovis, whose name was later Gallicized to Louis, stands glorious in France's history as the country's first king, the first of 19 Louis. Every French child knows the great words of the Bishop Remigius of Reims at the baptism. "Bow thy head, proud Frank. Adore what thou hast burned, burn what thou hast adored." Clovis died in 511, after partitioning his kingdom among his four sons, in accordance with the Frankish tradition of inheritance. The realm would soon have been subdivided into numerous tiny principalities, had not the excess of heirs been diminished by illness, poison, and accident, murder. These rulers were called the Merovingian kings, after Merowig, grandfather of Clovis. For ample reason, the later ones are also termed the Roi Fainéant, the do-nothing kings. The Merovingian government, feeble as it was, made an effort to find solutions to new problems. The Roman system of centralized administration and taxation had proved unworkable. The old civil service had disappeared. Effective power resided in the local magnates, new men, most of them Franks. The kings, therefore, appointed the magnates to be comites, counts, charging them with defence, administration, and the judgment of disputes according to local customs. The counts had to provide little armies. They enlisted them from among their subordinates, who were named knights and endowed with land. These armies were subject to call for the king's purposes, offensive or defensive. The counts paid no money to the king, for there was little money in circulation. The king was expected to support himself with the products of his royal or private domain. The system developed, in time, into feudalism. From the point of view of the king, it was a poor system. He received almost no revenues. He had nothing to give but land, and land, once given, never returned to him. He became poorer and poorer, more and more a do-nothing. By the mid-7th century, these pathetic kings gave up any serious effort to rule and contented themselves with outings in the royal ox cart driven by a ploughman. The effective master of the Merovingian state in peace and war was the major domo, the mayor of the palace, who eventually became strong enough to pass his office on to his sons. Naturally, these major domos were not long content to be king in all but name. A 20th-century tourist going back to visit France around the year 750 would have deemed it a crude and backward land like the rest of Western Europe. He would find the Eastern Empire much more congenial. A modern traveller would feel more at home in medieval Constantinople than anywhere else in Europe, says the scholar Christopher Brooke. It was a world in which many men were moderately well-educated, knew their Bible and their Greek classics, could talk sensibly about God and earthquakes and rising prices, a world in which money consisted in small change and large, with shops and commercial houses and factories the nearest thing one could meet in Europe to an industrial city, a world in which the gentlemen banded together in guilds and clubs. The visitor would be astounded by the emperor's magnificence, by his throne, which could be elevated high into the air, by his roaring artificial lions and his mechanical caroling birds. He would be impressed by the art and architecture, by the Church of Santa Sofia, one of the world's noblest structures. If he had scholarly tastes, he would admire the flourishing literature of the city, the general concern with theology and law. He might extend his journey to the realms of Islam. During the 7th and 8th centuries, the Arabs, inspired by Mohammed, conquered half the Western world. Their empire extended from India to Spain, threatening the Eastern Roman Empire and France and Italy. Commerce followed conquest. Islam controlled the seas. Its fleets and caravans traded with China. Magnificent new cities arose in eastern deserts. In the year 712, the Arabs crossed the Pyrenees and briefly held the French coast of the Mediterranean. They mounted a great invasion of France in 732, burned churches at Bordeaux and Poitiers, and were thrown back near Tours by the Franks under the leadership of Charles Martel, the Hammer, mayor of the palace. Tours marks the high point of Islam's tide. The Arab Empire was torn by the rivalries and dissensions which are the price of success. 100 years of conquest had sapped its zeal. The conquerors demanded their reward, peaceful enjoyment of their gains. When our traveller quitted the lands of Islam and the East, he would find himself in barbarous Europe, where life was hard, hungry, and dangerous. By and large, rule was exercised by strong men, mostly Germans, their hands always at the sword hilt. For survival, small landowners put themselves under the protection of the chiefs. Cities, providing few means of livelihood, became for the most part merely shelters for farmers or disappeared entirely. As central governments weakened, the church and its bishops took over many governmental functions. Bishops administered justice, undertook public works, defended their flocks, at need buckled on their swords and rode to war against foreign invaders or local aggressors. Laymen, from kings to serfs, feared the church's material and spiritual weapons and respected its rights, such as the right of sanctuary. The church was animated with missionary zeal. Early in the 5th century, St. Patrick, a Christian Briton who had learned the Irish language as a captive of Irish pirates, began the conversion of their barbarous island. The Irish church developed a special character. It was independent of Rome. It was entirely monastic in organization. Its clerics sought the most remote and uncomfortable retreats, even by some mysterious means, founding houses in uninhabited Iceland. They cultivated learning in their wildernesses. Many read Greek when that tongue was hardly known in Rome. They copied busily and beautifully the sacred texts and adorned them in a style of their own. The 8th or 9th century Book of Kells, now in Trinity College, Dublin, draws visitors as to a holy shrine. The Irish monks repaid St. Patrick by attempting the conversion of Scotland and Saxon Britain. In the 6th century, St. Columba proclaimed the faith from his headquarters on the bleak island of Iona, off the western Scottish coast. His disciple, St. Columban, invaded the continent and planted the seeds of the Spirit in pagan parts of France and present-day Switzerland. In the year 596, Pope Gregory the Great was inspired to send a missionary band of Benedictine monks to England. Their success brought them into conflict with the Irish monks, who followed certain minor religious practices unacceptable to Rome. The conflict was resolved in favour of the Romans, and Anglo-Saxon England was incorporated into the Roman Catholic system. English monks, in their turn, carried the faith to the Germanic peoples of the continent. The great English missionary St. Boniface, 680-755, founded, in what is now Germany, many monasteries, some of them still existent. Soon, nearly all of Western Europe was Christianized, though often not deeply. A chief would embrace the faith for personal advantage and would decree the mass baptism of his uncomprehending people. They could not forget their familiar woodland gods. They continued to offer prudent sacrifices to the spirits of trees, stones, and springs. Pagan rites were transposed to...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?